Good. Any questions from last time? I'm hoping to kill this off today so we can move on. But there's two things that I wanted to come back to from last class that one thing I promised to come back to you about the chemical potential of electric charge. And I think both the things I said were right, and they're both wrong depending on how you think about it. So the statement about electric charge would be that you don't need a chemical potential for it if it's true that you keep track of the interactions between the protons and the neutrons, the protons and electrons. The net charge, there'll be an energy price to having net charge be non-zero, which will make things neutral if you just leave the chemical potential zero. But if you're modeling things as basically very weakly interacting particles, then in the end of the day, you do need a chemical potential for the electrons to counteract the abundance of protons that you're left with. So that was kind of in passing. The other thing I wanted to come back to was I made an argument which was where the conclusion was true, but where one of the way I was arguing it to you wasn't quite right. So we had remember the bottom line was the culmination of what happened last time was the rate of change of the number density times the volume. So the rate of change of A cubed N was being set by our collision integral. If in the Boltzmann equation we were looking at distributions which were not varying with space very much, so we didn't care about the drift of particles, and if we were not worrying about applying forces to deviate particles from the geodesics. So that says that whenever either there's no interactions or there's equilibrium, we're expecting the number density to go like 1 over A cubed. So that was a very general statement. And then the way I argued this was when we did the integral over momenta, I was doing the integral over the co-moving momenta, and that wasn't quite right. So the better way to think about it is that what we've been talking about for the number density right from the get-go has been this. It's the integral over the momenta weighted by this factor that we found, the equilibrium factor. And the thing that so far I've not been emphasizing is the time dependence of everything, because normally in equilibrium, this function is a time-independent function, and the temperature is a time-independent function. And so once we introduce an expanding universe is when we're also saying that things like the temperature are time-dependent, and we're imagining that the time scale H, which is A dot over A, which is also comparable to T dot over T, as we've seen, that's something which is much smaller than the equilibrium time scales in the problem. That's kind of what goes into this equilibrium story. But these things are changing adiabatically. And so the way to see that this is going like 1 over A cubed is also the way to see why the temperature goes like 1 over A. And the issue there is what's the equation of state for, or what's the dispersion relation for a particle in a curved space? So the claim is, so question, an expanding universe, what are we supposed to be using for E squared as a function of P, or E as a function of P? In a flat universe, we would have used just E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared. And the claim is, and this is a, in a flat universe, another way of saying that A to mu nu, P mu, P nu, is equal to minus m squared. So in a curved universe, the important part of the statement is if we're going to use physical momenta here, which is what we're using here, the scale factor dependence, you can think of it many ways, and they all give you the same answer. One way to think of the scale factor dependence is that this condition should become g mu nu. Actually, I'm going to write it this way, g mu, p mu, p nu is equal to minus m squared. But we should be using not the flat metric, we should be using the FRW metric. I'll write it the first way, let's see. For what I want to say, it's going to be easier to see this way. And you know what's happening here is that the spatial parts of this metric are the ones that have the a squared in them. And so if we write this out, this would have been saying this is saying that minus e squared plus a squared p squared 3 vector squared equal to minus m squared. And that argues that what we should be using in curve space is a squared p squared, which is true. And the way to think about that is that you remember the physical momentum is the co-moving momentum divided by a. And so as a expands, the physical momentum is going to zero, but the energy is not doing anything and the mass is not doing anything. And the clearest way to see that is if the momentum was zero, the energy would be the mass. And so what should be happening is that as the universe expands, lengths are changing, but frequencies are not changing. And so this A is compensating for the fact that P is shrinking as the universe expands. So if we go back to here and ask, what's the time dependence? That allows us to make it explicit. There's a hidden time dependence in here. And so if we write that thing out, this is really D3P 2 pi cubed. E to the beta a squared p squared. Let me just take the relativistic case to make the point. So one way to think about this time dependence is that if I had written this as 1 over t, this is just telling you that this is as if the temperature was time dependent, because this is t over a. That's, we could have equally well called that the time-dependent temperature, provided we also said that mu was varying with time in the same way. So we could have written this as the integrand. We could have written, so I'm focusing on this integrand now. That's p minus mu of t divided by t of t, where t is proportional to 1 over a, and mu is proportional to 1 over a. So that's just telling you what you believed anyway, that this dispersion relation is another way of saying that the temperature for a relativistic system where there's no mass is behaving like it goes like one, it falls like 1 over a. But having done that, you can kind of see that this is effectively k. If we want to track the time dependence of n, if we had written this in terms of the co-moving momentum, this part would have been time independent. And so if we were to do that, then we pick up the overall 1 over a cubed. That we're expecting. And the way I phrased it last time, I was phrasing that we started off with integral d3k. I don't think I'd strictly lied to you, but I didn't make the point that this time dependence of the dispersion relation is yet another way of capturing that the temperature is going like 1 over a. And if we have relativistic systems, all the ways we have of thinking about what the energy density is, something we calculate from the statistical mechanics, something we calculate from energy conservation, they're all telling us that, or something we use thermodynamics for, they're all telling us that the temperature goes like 1 over a. And when it does go like 1 over a, all our distribution functions are just staying in exactly the way that the form that they wanted to have from equilibrium. So that's not new thoughts, but tidying up old thoughts. And the notational thing from the tutorial, you will have seen many times that, and you've used it before, that you're using the G star as the thing that's counting the number of degrees of freedom. And in my notes, I wasn't counting order one factors, and so there's missing factors of G star. And so in particular, when you're in a radiation-dominated universe, and H squared, which is always proportional to rho, all that's going on to this is that the curvature was zero, the spatial curvature was zero. Then if it's radiation dominated, then H is going like T squared, but there's this factor of G star, which is what we computed the other day, which is counting degrees of freedom. In units where n equals 2 is the photon, so we're counting the spin states separately, so it's every separate state that would have been in the count. So.
Why does the Boltzmann factor have K, minus
mu, not, I don't know, energy? Why does this have what? Because what it really was, it was just really E, right? And I'm saying if the mass were zero, then E is AP. That's what I'm saying. So you can also see that once you're non-relativistic, if this is going to become, if E is comparable to M, then it's not true that thinking of the temperature as going like 1 over A is keeping the shape of the distribution the same. It's really special about relativistic systems. So it's only when I can drop the mass that I can just think of this thing as being always in this relativistic, in this equilibrium form where I just have a time-dependent t. All right, that was housekeeping. So we're almost where we want to be. And where we want to be, remember, is we want to know what the abundance is of particles as they freeze out, or as things are in equilibrium. Densities are falling of the particles in equilibrium. Particularly as you pass through the mass of the particle, then they start to drop like a rock because you get a Boltzmann suppression of e to the minus m over t. And so at some point, the reaction rates in that collision term become small, so small that they can't respond anymore to the expansion of the universe. And so once, the last thing we talked about last time is that once the reaction rates become much less than the Hubble scale, then C cannot adjust, the collision term cannot adjust to maintain the equilibrium form, And so what we want to do is we want to track so once that happens, the corresponding particle, if it's no longer in equilibrium, its energy density, it's not like we don't know what it is anymore, it's particle density. The beauty of that formula up there is that when the right-hand side is vanishing, we know that n goes like 1 over a cubed, and there's two ways in which C could vanish. One could be that the interactions have turned off, so that means that they're so rare that we don't need to include them, or it could be true that they're fast, but they're in equilibrium. In either case, though, we know n goes like 1 over a cubed, and so the important thing will be that number densities of particles, and that includes photons in equilibrium and dark matter particles that are not in equilibrium, are all falling in the same way with time. So since n proportional to 1 over a cubed, both for equilibrium and in absence of interactions, it's useful to track eta, which is ratios. If we have a particle species I, and divided by some reference particle species, and the one that people always use is photons, because those are easy to measure. And photons are in equilibrium until recombination, after which point they're not in equilibrium anymore. But after then, in both cases, when they're equilibrium or not, C is vanishing, and so the number of photons is going like 1 over a cubed. And we know the number of photons is essentially 0.2 times t cubed, if you put in all the numbers that we had before, because it's a relativistic thing, and that's true both when it's equilibrium and when it's not in equilibrium. And so when I tell you this for two reasons. One is that we had a whole story about what the chemical potential was for baryons, and the upshot of that story was that we chose a baryon chemical potential to arrange that the proton density is not zero, or the baryon density is not zero. And the way to express that is in terms of this ratio. So we chose, and I'm telling you this because we're going to compare the dark matter to the baryons, we chose the chemical potential for baryons to ensure NB is not zero. How not zero is it? You know, the observed value is always given in terms of this ratio because that's the time-independent thing. So that's NB for N gamma, and that's basically 10 to the minus 10. So that's the thing that we use as our benchmark for adjusting the chemical potential for baryons. For dark matter, we're going to want to do a similar thing. So for dark matter, so suppose, you know, the dark matter falls out of equilibrium at t TF, which is the freeze-out temperature, then the amount of dark matter we're going to have now, T now, will be equal to eta for the dark matter times the number of photons now. But we know how many of the photons there are. That's basically and eta is the thing is because eta is independent of time, we can evaluate whenever we want. But the thing that would be useful is to evaluate it at the freeze-out time. So this will be the number of amount of dark matter at freeze-out, the number of photons at freeze-out. And so the way we estimate the dark matter abundance now is we calculate what this is at freeze-out, and then we know it's just going to be the same from then on. And so the change in the dark matter abundance from freeze-out to now is just really to do with the overall expansion of the universe, and it's tracking the amount by which the number of photons has been diluted. So the key thing is we want to be able to calculate what this abundance is at freeze-out. And we know that before freeze-out, it was equilibrium, so we can use these kind of arguments. And so the whole question comes down to the zeroth order approximation would be we have an equilibrium abundance until we get to the freeze-out temperature, and at that point, they drop out of equilibrium. And after that point, they are frozen. So then this ratio is fixed. And so all we really need to know is to calculate what the temperature was where freeze-out happened, and then we're in business, because what we'll know is that the equilibrium abundance at that point was the last time that the dark matter particles were talking to the thermal environment, and their abundance then, normalized by the photon abundance, will be the abundance you see now. That's kind of the argument you were using in the tutorial. So to compute the relic abundance, or to estimate. If you want to do a better job than this, then what you do is you go back to the Boltzmann equation, which is tracking the abundances if equilibrium is not true in detail, and you can kind of watch interactions go into leave equilibrium as you pass through the freeze-out temperature. So what we need is need the temperature at freeze-out. And the way we have to calculate that is we have to ask, so to figure this out is we need to know when does the equilibrium condition fail? This condition here. You know, the equilibrium argument was relying on the reaction rates were fast, so the collision term is always adjusting. If you've got rates going both directions, as long as the reactions in equilibrium are very fast, which is the whole spirit of statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, is that what's happening in collision by collision is happening very fast compared to the time scales of interest to you, then they will adjust in such a way as to keep the right-hand side zero, and then all the equilibrium arguments that led to this are holding. But that's relying on the reaction rates being fast compared to the timescales of interest to us. But the timescales of interest to us in cosmology are the timescales to do with the fact that all these thermodynamic properties are changing because we're expanding the universe. So this whole equilibrium argument is relying on the adjustment of C to be stay zero is happening faster than the universe is expanding. So that's why once the reaction rates fall below the Hubble scale, then what's happening is that they can't adjust quickly enough to compensate for the density changes that are happening as the universe is expanding. The universe expands, the densities go down, the reaction rates go down, and then they can fail to cancel, and they can't adjust quickly enough to compensate and bring themselves back to zero if they can't move as fast as the universe is moving. So what we have to ask is, for dark matter, when are the the equilibrating interactions, much bigger than H, fail. And so this is where So we have to go back and ask. So what was the? How did the reaction rates depend on? And you remember that in the very first class. So you have to recall that that the reaction rate per particle is given by the average over whatever the initial particles you have, whatever the distribution is. It's the number density times the cross section times V. And this is really the definition of sigma. Normally what you would do is when the first class we're talking about what the rates were that were canceling each other, the rate was the thing that was equal to distribution functions times some S matrix element. And I made the argument that the S matrix element was unitary. And so having the rates in both directions be equal was a statement about the distribution functions. And this is the same statement where this is the initial distribution function. In the average and the sum over the final states, you would see the other statistical factors if they're there. And this is really a definition of what's this is the relative velocity of the particles involved. So here I'm imagining that we have a two-particle interaction. A plus B goes to C plus D. Those are the ones that are usually the important ones, because if you have, when the equilibrium is failing, what's happening is that the number densities are becoming small and particles are having trouble finding counterparts to scatter with. When you have a dilute system like that, reactions involving two particles are always more more frequent than reactions involving three, because it's hard enough to find one partner to dance with, but if you have to find two at a time, that's much more rare. And so there's going to be, in this limit where the interactions are becoming rare, two-party processes should dominate. And for them, this relative velocity is the relative velocity between these guys. And it's appearing because that's essentially the definition of the cross-section is it's the rate where you're dividing by the stuff that's specific to the specifics of your interactions, of how you set the experiment up. Sigma is supposed to be the thing that has all the interaction-specific things, and these are the things that are specific to the setup of your experiment, how many things in your target, or how many things in your beam, and what's the relative speed with which they arrive. So for us, we know what N is. N is thermal, because we're starting in a thermal state. This is the thermal abundance. So we know what that is. And sigma V is the thing that sigma V is given once you specify the reaction that's evolved. So this reaction. And you did the exercise in the tutorial where if you cycle through a variety of interactions, like the electromagnetic interactions or the weak interactions, you can kind of ask in the thermal bath of stuff that was in the standard model, the neutrinos and the electrons and positrons and the protons, you can ask at what point do they each fall out of equilibrium by applying this condition for specific reactions. If you're interested in neutrinos, then it would be the ones where the neutrinos are scattering with things in the bath and exchanging energy with them. And if you use what the cross-section for the weak interactions are and how it depends on temperature in the expression for the rate, and you compare it to the Hubble scale, then you see that the temperature below which the rate falls below the Hubble scale defines the temperature where neutrinos fall out of equilibrium, and that's the MeV scale. So the whole story, which I'm assuming when I say this you've seen, so the people took the cosmology course, you've been through the history of particle events in the early universe, I'm assuming, right? So that you start off with the earliest one we know about is nucleosynthesis, where the nuclei form, and then there's then at some point so you start off basically at an MeV. So I guess the first thing that happens is that the neutrinos fall out of equilibrium, and then the nuclei form, and then after that at some point the electrons and positrons annihilate, and then they heat up the things that are in equilibrium with electrons and positrons, but the neutrinos don't heat up because they weren't talking to them at that point. And then at that point, after that, atoms form. That whole history of things, did you go through those examples? Yeah, good. So I'm just not saying anything different from that. I'm just What we're doing is applying the same logic to the dark matter interaction. So now let's go back to the Wimp miracle. So if our dark matter consists of particles with masses of something like 100 GeV, just to start off with, and interactions with cross-section times V set by the weak interactions, and the claim is that the relic abundance from a thermal state, an initially thermal state, you know, that includes no chemical potential, so mu equals zero for the dark matter. Gives, you know, an acceptable relic dark matter abundance. And the way we prove that is we just take weak interaction cross sections, we use thermal distributions, we plug it into that, and we ask, when is that true? And we're thinking that it's going to be true roughly at the point where the temperature is near the mass of the particle involved. So we're imagining that things are at thermal equilibrium up at temperatures near 100 GeV, so much higher than any of the things we have direct evidence for otherwise. Turn the crank. What we'll do is we'll, in thermal equilibrium, we figure out what the number density of the dark matter compared to the photons was then. We figure out the freeze-out temperature by asking that condition, and then we just use this to run down to low energies, and we read off what the abundance is, and then the claim is that it all just works for free. So you're all good on what the logic is here. Good. So let's get going. So what we need to know is what are the interaction rates? The interaction cross sections for the weak interaction. So you know what's going on in the weak interactions is that you're scattering, particles are scattering through the exchange of a W or a Z particle. And the masses there are, you know, the W mass is 80 GeV, the Z mass is 90 GeV. So what we want to know the energy dependence or the temperature dependence of that rate. And so we need to know the energy dependence of the interactions. And that will depend on how energetic the scattering is compared to these scales, right? So if the energy of the scattering is much less, say, than the W mass, then what happens is that, you know, the W is essentially, it's being produced instantaneously. And so then there's some coupling constant G. So the cross section times V is going to be, proportional to, so it'll be G squared. Actually, let's do it in two steps. So the amplitude as a function of energy, in this case, is going to have two G's in it. It's going to have a 1 over MW squared in it because it had a propagator, which we're Taylor expanding in powers of E divided by MW. So it'll start off with 1 over mw squared, because propagators are going like p squared plus m squared. And so if this is small, we're starting with a 1 over m squared. And then there'll be other factors, which will be to do with the energy, which we're going to get on dimensional grounds. So that means that sigma v is going to go like the amplitude squared. So this is what we're going to call the Fermi constant. And strictly speaking, the Fermi constant would have been this. So there's factors of 2 running around. But we're going to get this thing squared. That has dimensions of 1 over mass squared. And so when you square it, it's got dimensions of 1 over mass to the fourth. This has got the dimensions of length squared. because V is dimensionless, as C is 1. And so length squared is 1 over energy squared. So that means we're missing a factor of energy squared. So this thing is going to go like G squared energy squared, if the energy is much less than the W mass squared. It'll really be the center mass energy that'll appear here. Because you could have asked, so whose energy, what frame are we talking about when we talk about the energy? And everybody agrees on what the center mass energy is. And so if you do this in a thermal bath, and if the rest frame of the fluid is also the rest frame of the collision, then the center mass energy is going to be basically the temperature. So what we expect is that if this is the regime, so in a thermal bath, then N sigma V is going to be something like the thermal distribution as a function of temperature times GF squared T squared. And this will depend on whether the particles are relativistic or not, right? So if they're relativistic particles, this will be some number, which was 0.1 something times the number of degrees of freedom times T cubed. And so you see that the total rate here is, for relativistic particles, going to go like G Fermi squared T to the fifth. And the dimensions work because this goes like 1 over mass to the fourth. This goes like mass to the fifth. So this goes like mass, and rate is 1 over time. So it should go like mass or energy. You can kind of see the dimensions had to work here because this is going 1 over length cubed. This is a length squared, so this is 1 over length. This is length over time, so this whole thing has dimensions of 1 over time, and that's why it makes sense for it to be a rate. But that all was true if this is so, and that's not really the regime we want to be in. This is what you would have done if you were doing neutrinos. Neutrinos, this expression, neutrinos are relativistic, and they're interacting in this way at these energies. This would have given you the temperature where neutrinos decouple. So for neutrinos, what we would ask is we'd ask gamma being faster than H is the statement that G Fermi squared T to the fifth is bigger than H, which is, remember, H squared was what we're calling G star times T squared over M Planck squared. So this is the square root of G star times T over M Planck squared T to the fourth. Because rho, this is assuming it's radiation dominated. Because then we know that rho goes like T to the fourth. And so the condition for T would have been that T cubed has to be bigger than square root of G star over G Fermi squared M Planck. So that should eventually be right because this is 1 over mass to the fourth times mass is 1 over mass cubed. It was a numerator, take that cube root. And this is the thing that evaluates to, you know, so you can kind of see what's happening here is that the G Fermi is, it turns out to be 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. So G Fermi squared times M Planck is going to be 10 to the minus 10 times M Planck is 10 to the 18 GeV, so that's 10 to the 18. That'll be in GeV to the minus 3. That's 10 to the 8th, 10 to the minus 10 to the 8th GeV to the minus 3. So when we take 1 over that, if we just forget about the G star for now, we're going to get something here, which is, say that was 10 to the 9, this would have been 10 to the 3 cubed. So this is going to point us towards 10 to the 3 GeV. Way too big. What happened there? Oh, because I can't do algebra. This is 10 to the 8th. Cube root of this would be 10 to the 3. 1 over that is 10 to the minus 3. And then we'd have 10 to the minus 3 GeV, which is about an MeV, and that's the right answer. So this says that for neutrinos, that equilibrium for neutrinos holds for T bigger than something of the order of G star square root over G Fermi squared M Planck to the 1/3, which is the square root of, it's G star to the 1/6. That's something which is a number of order 10 to the 1/6. That's basically 1. Then it's 10 to the minus 3 GeV, which is about an MeV, which is where the neutrinos are freezing out. And then what's useful about that is that they freeze out just before the nucleosynthesis forms, because the nucleosynthesis forms when the proton-neutron, there's a whole bunch of coincidences. This temperature is an MeV, the neutron-proton mass difference is an MeV, the binding energy of a deuteron is an MeV, you know, the age of the universe at that time is an MeV. So a whole bunch of things are very are happening at the same time, and so the competition of all those effects is what controls the abundance of nuclei. So that's supposed to just give you confidence that that kind of an estimate is giving you things that you believe you should be getting. Let's just repeat that exercise now for the dark matter. The only difference is that the dark matter, we're assuming, is decoupling when temperatures are of the order of its mass. And so that those energies are not small compared to the W mass, because the W mass is kind of 100 GeV. We're interested in 100 GeV, so we're not clearly in this low energy regime. So at higher energies, so if energies are bigger than or of the order of MW, then really what we should be having is the energy of the exchange now. We were doing a Taylor expansion in energy divided by the mass in using this formula, and we shouldn't be doing that. We should just be thinking of the energy and the mass, they're all the same size. So what we can do is just think of the energy as playing the role of mass here. And so what we'll instead have, the amplitude will go like G squared still, but then it'll be some function of energy, because there's not a hierarchy between the energy and the mass. So sigma V should go like G to the fourth times the appropriate power of energy. What's the appropriate power of energy? That's something which gives you a length squared. So that will be 1 over energy squared. And again, it's going to want to be the center mass energy squared, because that's the thing that everybody agrees on. So, but otherwise, it's the same estimate. So if we want to know what the reaction rate as a function of temperature will be, it's going to be the number density times sigma times V. Now, in this case, we're interested our interest is interest in temperatures of the order of the mass of the dark matter particle, because we're interested in where the freeze out happens, and we know that the temperature, the density of the dark matter particles just goes along for the ride, then all of a sudden it drops like a rock at the temperatures of the order of the mass. So it's right around there that we're thinking that we're going to see the things fall out of equilibrium. So that just is the flag that we should be here thinking about. At that point, you know, the temperatures and the mass are all same size as the energy, so they're not going to change the estimate of the cross section, but the density is going to change, and that's kind of why we're interested in this region. It's dropping like a stone, because we know that as things become non-relativistic, n starts to have this exponential suppression. So what we should be using there is the non-relativistic distribution. So n should be mt over 2 pi to the 3 halves e to the minus m over t. That was what we found for the non-relativistic case with no chemical potential. This is where we're using that it's thermal. Sigma v is basically of the order of that. So it's let's call this, if alpha is g squared over 4 pi, let's just call this alpha squared over v squared. So we're going to have alpha squared over, it doesn't really matter if we use temperature and the energies are going to be roughly the same, the mass, they're all roughly the same. And so what we're getting here is that gamma of t is going to be something like mt over 2 pi, 3 halves, e to the minus m over t, times alpha squared over t squared. And we want that to be bigger than the Hubble scale, which is the square root of g star t squared over m Planck. And this is our criterion for equilibrium. And the point where this fails, so where this has become comparable, that's what we mean by freeze out, right? So that'll be t freeze out, freeze out, freeze out, freeze out, freeze out. And have I done this right? The one thing that I worry about is this, because that's actually probably, this is true under the assumption that the energy, kinetic energy, is dominating. And it's true that numerically they're all the same size. The temperature and the mass are similar. But it's true that if we're going to follow the temperature dependence of things, which is what we're trying to do, we should be careful here. So what we're doing here is we're doing cross sections where we're specifically interested in when the energies associated are of the order of the mass. So I think a better and a more accurate treatment of the temperature dependence is I should be using the mass here. Although the size is the same, as I vary the temperature, the cross section is not doing anything dramatic. And putting the temperature here would have made it sound like the cross section is actually getting bigger and smaller. So let me put the mass here. So let's solve for t, right? So then the solution is, so if we take this and think of it as being 2 minus a half, we would have had 2 pi mt to the 1 half. Then we would have had mt 2 pi squared is equal to, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave this as sigma v, and then we can put in whatever we want later on. Let's just do that. Then e to the minus m over t is of the order of, so we've got square root of g star, tf squared over sigma v times m Planck. So the t's cancel. This is left over. This doesn't depend on temperature, so I'll put it on this side. So we got 2 pi over mt. Actually, no. What I'd like to have is m over t, right? So let's do that differently. What did I do here? Yeah. So let's just pull out. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to write it where I've got a factor of t squared, which I can cancel out, and I want to just track the m's. So let's do that. So we have So let's write that as mt over 2 pi squared, which is what I did, because I want to cancel that off. And then I had 2 pi over mt to the 1 half. So then I cancel that out. I should keep that. And what's left now is that if I group these terms, I've got, if I keep one factor of m to go with that one, that'll turn this into m over t, and the other one I'll put on the other side. So we'll have 2 pi m over t square root e to the minus m over t is 2 pi the square root of g star over sigma v m Planck. And that's it, right? Let me just see what I compare to what I know is true. Somehow I got the 2 pi's wrong. That's what happened. Oh, I forgot to bring it. Yeah, thank you. That's the only thing, I think. 2 pi, good. So that's our condition. And then what we're thinking of is, if I want to, I can stick in what sigma v is. So sigma v, I'm going to think of as being alpha squared over m squared if I want to. But what's useful about this is that it shows you what your knobs are, right? If you get something which works, which we are, and you want to start changing m and coupling constants, and you want to know, how do I preserve that I'm getting things right, the thing you're adjusting is essentially that combination. And so you can see right here exactly what everybody is depending on. So sigma v times m is really alpha squared over m. So this is going to go like m over alpha squared. And so if you bring m down and you bring alpha squared down in exactly the same ratio, then everything that I'm going to tell you now is going to work equally well. So there's a whole range of solutions here that start at the one I'm giving you. So let's just bring it all home. So the thing I'm giving you is in those notes that are on the webpage. But the one thing to watch in those notes is that I was not tracking G star in the answer. So you should just keep track of that factor. All right, so now what we want to do is we want to connect the dots and get to see what the abundance is. So we've got m over 2 pi. That was 2 pi square root of g star over sigma v. And what we're trying to figure out is we want to know, so eta at t freeze out is going to be the number density divided by the photon number density. So that's the 1 over the photon density was 0.2 times t freeze out cubed, and so times the number density. And the number density is m t over 2 pi to the 3 halves e to the minus m t freeze out. So our prediction for eta is that, and the value we want for t is that, or this. And so let's estimate how big it's going to be. So before I do that, though, so you can, this connects to the last dot that you're using for the assignment. That for the assignment for the scalar example, that expression for that you're using to determine the freeze-out temperature is this one, basically. Where you have a statement for what sigma v is and the various limits where the masses are, whatever they are. And then the way that you're getting, the logic you're using to get the density, the relic density is exactly the same logic as we're doing here. All right, so we might as well bring the t's inside, right? So this is basically 5 times, because I 1 over 0.2, then this t goes into that in the denominator. So you know what m over t is, then, which you do, then you know what eta is. And so so we need to know what m over t is, and this is kind of it's a transcendental equation. You know, if you think of m over t being, you know, x, then, and you put this on the other side, you're trying to solve the equation that square root of x is a constant times the exponential of x. So if the exponential of x is something like that, square root of x is something like that. They may or may not cross depending on the normalization of the exponential. If you make it smaller, then the exponential gets slower, and then they will cross. If you make it larger, they needn't cross, or they will cross at larger values. So it's kind of a transcendental problem. But to get a feeling for it, this side, the variation of the sensitivity to m over t is really strong in the exponential. So the first approximation, you can just drop that to get a ballpark. And for the ballpark then would be that you're expecting m over t, or t, yeah, m over t freeze out should be something like the logarithm of sigma v m Planck over 2 pi square root of g star. And let's use sigma v is alpha squared over m squared. So then we can write this as alpha squared over m. And so then the thing inside this logarithm, there's two pi's and there's g stars, but the big things are the alphas and the m's. So we know that alpha squared, or actually before we even do that, we can just directly use it here, that if we, what we want is basically these factors, if we're thinking of them as not changing much, what we really want is this exponential, which is here. So let's just evaluate that. So up to logarithms, this is something like 5, which is probably overkill to keep the 5. Let's just do the order of magnitude. So we got, this we said was m over alpha squared m Planck. Did I get that right? Times logs are the same kind of a thing. Something of order logarithm. That sounds funny to me. Why does that sound funny to me? Anyway, let's press on. I think that's, it looks okay. So that would say that we're expecting that eta at freeze out is of the order of this. So that's m over m Planck. If this is 100 GV and m Planck is 10 to the 18th GV, then this is 10 to the minus 16. So m over m Planck, 1 over alpha squared, it's going to be 10 to the minus 16 times 10 to the 4. That's 10 to the minus 2, 12. And for comparison, remember, what was the answer for baryon? So for baryons, we know that's something which doesn't depend on time because it's the ratio of two densities, and that was, remember, 10 to the minus 10. So what we're saying here is that the dark matter, so eta dark matter is something like 10 to the minus 2 of eta baryon, is what this is telling us. And so that's great, because if that was true then, it'll be true now, because the whole point of eta is that it's not changing much. So that means that the number density of dark matter now should be something like 10 to the minus 2 times the number density of baryons now. Call them capital B for baryon. But what we want is the energy density in this stuff. So the energy density in dark matter now will be 10 to the minus 2 times the ratio of their masses, dark matter to baryon, times the energy density in baryons now. But if this is 100 GV and these are protons and that's 1 GV, that's basically a factor of 100. So this is basically the energy density in baryons now. If I'd kept the 5, which would have been a bit of a lie, so if I kept that 5, you know, I would have had 5, 5, 5. And then you would have been happy. 5 is what the right answer is, right? The baryons are 5% of the universe and the dark matter is 25% of the universe. But really, there's an order one factor here which you want to track through, because I'm, you know, the logarithm is there. But the main message is that, you know, the fact that you're close is the miracle. So this is where, you know, can I have an amen? It's this is the thing where nothing dramatic went into this. All you had to have was weak interaction cross-section, had to have a mass like all the other masses of particles that we're finding in the LHC now. We wish we were finding in the LHC now. But the Z boson mass, the top mass, they're all kind of in that ballpark. We know particles exist with this mass. We know that they can have these interactions because the weak interactions exist. And if we just assume that they were in thermal equilibrium at the weak scale, hey presto, the abundance that you get out is the abundance that you want. And it's kind of a, you might have said, there's a miracle, and the miracle kind of, I guess, is coming from this. We have no explanation as to why this number is what it is. Remember, we get this by putting in a chemical potential. So that's the thing that we just dial in. And so given that we did that, and we found this, we get to this statement, which is the one that is a successful statement. So a missing step in the whole story is where did this come from? And that's, no one knows, and you'd like to have a story like this where you go to earlier times and ask, Where did the baryons, why did the baryons shake out at the size that they had? But from the miracle point of view, this is great at two levels. You get the abundance you want, and once you have the abundance you want, all of those pieces of evidence for dark matter are going to go through as long as non-relativistic things under gravity give you what you see. And the most doubtful place there is the details of the galaxy the structure of galaxies, and that's not yet clear whether or not non-interacting non-relativistic particles get that right. But the other thing that's nice is that we know that these kind of masses with these kinds of interactions, you can detect, because we do detect particles with those kind of masses and those kinds of interactions. And so the whole program for direct dark matter searches is relying on that. If this basic reaction that we looked at involved dark matter particle, let's call it chi, annihilating a dark matter particle, say, through some process, some weak interaction process, weak scale, or weak strength, and giving you standard model particles, let's say. And so that's the reaction which just did a nice thing for us. And so the next nice thing that you can hope for is that one of the things you get from relativistic, remember that whole story of, in relativistic field theory, the fact that you've got relativity of simultaneity and particles and antiparticles had to be able to go back and forth between two events that could have been in any order in time, it says many things. And one of the things it says is that particles and antiparticles appear with the same interaction strength. And that tells you that implies crossing symmetry, that if I have a reaction where I have a final particle, I can put it on the other side and think of it as being an antiparticle, and the rate, essentially the amplitude doesn't change. The phase space could change, but the amplitude doesn't change. And so that means that I can think of time in this, the rate for a process where instead of time flowing that way, if time flowed that way, it would be the same basic strength of a cross section, because what I'm doing is I'm taking this guy and putting it from the final state into the initial state and this guy into the final state, and I'm using essentially crossing symmetry to say that the rate for that should be basically the same. So that means that a weak interaction cross section that's giving us a nice annihilation process in the early universe should also give us a process where these things scatter from nuclei in detectors, then you can look for them. And we know that you can see things that are scattering with weak interaction strength in detectors because neutrinos do that, and there are neutrino detectors. So these big tanks underground, you can also use them as dark matter detectors where you have some nucleus, you hit it with the dark matter is flying around because we're in the galaxy, it's full of dark matter, and we're moving through the galaxy. So the dark matter comes in, hits something, and you watch for the recoil of the thing that it hits, let's say. And so the program for looking for dark matter in direct detectors is living off the fact that the cross sections that you need are plausibly of the order of the weak interactions. They could be different if you adjust the scenario a little bit, but it's the basic benchmark. This WIMP miracle is telling you that the cross sections and masses you're looking for are things that you could very well see. You would not have seen them before they started looking because they're sufficiently high and sufficiently weakly interacting that they're not in your face. But what you need for the abundance is exactly what you would need for the detection of these things. And that's why, to close out the dark matter story, if you kind of ask for the preponderance, if you had to make a bet now that nobody leaves the room with any money unless they give a reasonably good bet for what they think dark matter is, the safe bet is that it's probably particles, because particle models are very generically give you what you want. You have to make the particle stable, so that's easy to do. Give it a charge that it's the lightest thing that carries that charge. But then once you do that, all the lines of evidence for dark matter all come together and they work so far as we can tell. Whereas the alternative to that, like modifying gravity, whatever your alternative is, that may be the way nature works, but right now, no proposals get all the lines of evidence right. They're difficult to construct. You should let your equations talk to you, and those equations are telling you, I don't want to work. Whereas these equations are telling you, it's really easy to work. And so it doesn't mean that nature works this way, but if you're making bets, this is the one that's the plausible one now. Yeah?
What does it say about galaxy
rotation? Well, so what this would say is that it says that you've got some profile, when I hand out the notes for this, I put in some profiles. And so that's the stickiest one. You get something an example would be if you simulate non-interacting particles, and you let them run under galaxies. You start them off uniformly, and you let them go in the expanding universe, then you get these halos. And the density that numerical simulations point you towards do things like they go like some number, you know, over R, you know, 1 plus R over RS squared or something like that. This is the NFW profile. And so this does two things that are funny, right? Because I told you that, you know, V squared in Newtonian physics would have gone like GM over R over R. So if M is the integral to R, you know, D R hat of R hat squared rho, if rho was going like 1 over R, then this integral would go like R and the R's would cancel and that would give you a constant V. So I told you then that it's like rho goes like 1 over R squared. But for large R, this is not going like 1 over R squared, right? This is going like 1 over R cubed. And for small R, this is going like 1 over R. And there's no evidence, essentially, for dark matter in the centers of galaxies. So this makes a specific prediction for what you would see in galaxies. And I would say it makes a worse prediction than the modified gravity did, the Mond did. Because Mond kind of nailed that V squared was a constant, and it nailed that the constant it stops at is correlated with the luminosity, which fits, you know, just fits the Tully-Fisher relationship. Whereas this is fighting. You look at this and you say, well, it's not really giving me what I want. But what's not clear yet is that when people predict this, they're doing simulations where they have dark matter and no baryons, say. If you look at the kind of the cuspiness at the R equals zero, that's the place where you've got lots of baryons. And so what's not clear yet is whether or not you've neglected in these simulations things that are as big as what you're trying to track. And so that's why people don't yet cross dark matter models off. But I think this is the smelliest part of dark matter models, is how they do the velocity curves. In this is part of it. The other part of it is if you look at the abundance of galaxies that there should be, cold dark matter seems to give you more potential wells in which galaxies could have formed than you see when you look at the galaxies around us. So there's a couple things like that are bothersome on small scales. So I think the fair thing to say about dark matter is that no one thing just really comes out and says, we just nailed it all and there's no doubt. But I think that the hedge you make for dark matter is essentially this hedge, but you get everything else right, and theoretically it's really easy to do. And the alternatives aren't as good as that. That's where we are, I think. Yeah?
But so you have this non-renormalizable effective theory, right? So this four-particle contact direction.
No, it didn't have to be.
But it's, you have this kind of mass that is sitting in there, and you don't really know where that comes from. You say it's a weak scalar.
I misled you, because it's... So when we were doing neutrinos, I did that. But for the example you're doing your homework on, that's renormalizable. There's nothing non-renormalizable about any of that. Because I'm never using this contact interaction kind of a thing. People often do, if they're interested at low energy scattering, and they usually do that when they're looking at direct detection, where they're thinking the scattering is at having very low energies. But almost all the models that people write down are renormalizable in the usual sense.
The question would be the same: like, what could that be? I mean, that interaction that you have. I mean, it's the scale of the weak interaction, but it is not.
Right.
You're not saying it is the weak interaction.
Well, in that example that you do in the homework, what it is it's the Higgs exchange. So it's every boson is an interaction, and the Higgs is one, and that's the one that's important. So the thing is, you could make it the ordinary weak interactions if you want, because you could have a particle which is just taking part of the weak interactions. It could be that you have a new interaction. But the thing I guess that I would say about those things is that the scale that you're asking particles to exist at and to have interactions the size of are scales that you're thinking about anyway for other reasons, nothing to do with cosmology. And so people normally go to town with supersymmetry, because supersymmetry was an example where you had lots of particles like that, and you had a good reason why some of them were stable, because there's a conserved charge very often. But I think that was really oversold. I think it's true that was actually great, because that was a class of theories designed for some complete reason that nothing to do with cosmology, which also then might have been good for cosmology. But the message is bigger than that, because it's really, if you don't like supersymmetry, almost everything you do when you're trying to fix the problems of the standard model is happening at that scale with those masses and with those interactions. So it's really very vanilla what you're doing. But it's true that it's new. It's not something which has been seen before. But that's true for all the problems. Every proposal in town is new. So that's something which they all share, yeah. Including modified gravity. They're all, I think that it's, I'm not trying to just dissuade anybody from working. One of the Weinberg's advices for physics people, graduate students that are starting their research, is not to dive in where things are the that look the best, it's to dive in where things look the worst, because that's where you're going to make an impact. So if it's true that dark matter gravity models are smelly, maybe it means somebody should go in there and find one that really looks good, and that'll be the one that really convinces everybody. So it's important that people think through all these alternatives, but every once in a while you should also sit back and say, well, if I had to bet money, which one looks more plausible? Yeah. It depends on your energy range. What you're really tracking here is the energy dependence of sigma v. And if you were in a very ultra relativistic regime where all you had is an energy, then on dimensional grounds it would go like 1 over energy squared. If you're very low energies where the energy of your scattering is much less than the mass in your problem, then it goes like 1 over mass squared. And so the temperature dependence that you use is essentially tracking the energy dependence that you use, and that depends on what the regime is of energy. How your temperature compares to the mass in your problem.
Yeah, I remember we regard dark matter as a kind of scalar, and we use the scattering of fermions and we calculate that scattering amplitude, and we got it like a sigma v proportional to t squared over m by the force.
Well, when you calculate sigma v, you probably got it like a constant because you're doing it at the threshold, but then when you compared it to the Hubble scale, that's where you got it to go like t squared. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
When you compare it to the Hubble scale is always going like t squared if it's radiation dominated. So that might be what you're thinking of, because it's what I remember about that calculation is that that's very much like this one. When you actually calculate what the cross-section is, you're interested in these very non-relativistic things where the temperature and the mass are almost the same. So then effectively, using something like this where it's not depending on energy is a good approximation because you're at the threshold of the they're very non-relativistic particles that are scattering. But when you compare it to H is a thing that's always going like T squared, because that's written down here somewhere. It's over there. H squared is going like T to the fourth, so H is going like T squared. It's true. So that difference is whether or not you're talking about relativistic or non-relativistic things. So far I've been talking about sigma v, but if you talk about n, then you have to use, if you're in the relativistic regime, you should be using n as going like t cubed. If you're in the non-relativistic regime, then it's the square root of mt times the exponential of e to the minus m over t. So once you choose what the temperature is compared to the mass, that tells you what n should be, and that tells you what expression to use to get the temperature dependence of gamma. So if you have a specific example, I can probably argue through what it was if you show it to me, but it's Probably good. Our friend is in the back.